Both sides have up to 15 minutes to argue in this matter. And good morning to whoever is going to approach. You are, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today for ConAgra. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to focus on three basic problems with the $108 million judgment in this case. First, there's no evidence in this record that Jacobs paid even a penny or any, much less all, of the settlements. That point alone requires reversal. It's Jacobs' burden to establish that it's the real party in interest with standing to invoke the court's jurisdiction, and Jacobs failed to carry that burden. To the contrary, Jacobs successfully resisted discovery into who paid the various settlements and now must live with that decision. Second, this lawsuit represents an end run around the workers' comp system. Fully $95 million of these settlements went to ConAgra's own employees who received workers' comp and couldn't sue ConAgra directly. This court has long recognized that an employer's workers' comp immunity extends to third-party suits seeking indemnification to employees unless the employer expressly waives such immunity. There's nothing in the general indemnification provision here to indicate that ConAgra waived its workers' comp immunity, so it didn't. And third, the trial court incorrectly instructed the jury on the critical issue of causation. The court should have told the jury that they could only award indemnification insofar as the settlements were caused by ConAgra and not by Jacobs' own litigation misconduct.
Did ConAgra encourage the first settlement?
ConAgra sent a letter in the first settlement, that's Exhibit 1453, saying that the settlement would not be with prejudice to any indemnification rights that Jacobs may have, but it absolutely never conceded that they did have indemnification rights. And this, again, goes to a really critical point here, which is what is the indemnification issue here? And I'd really like to focus, following up on your question, Your Honor, with this workers' comp issue, because there's been a serious debate on the meaning of the contract. And I'd like to clarify how that Section 10.2 works. That's the provision where ConAgra agrees to indemnify Jacobs. That provision is just one sentence long and consists of two clauses. The first clause limits Jacobs' liability, or it confirms that Jacobs' liability is otherwise limited in the contract. It says, Jacobs' liability, however arising by reason of the performance of the services, is specifically limited as provided herein. The second clause then goes on to say, and ConAgra will indemnify and release Jacobs against all other claims, in other words, for which ConAgra is negligent. In other words, Jacobs' liability is limited, but insofar as it's not limited, ConAgra will indemnify Jacobs for losses caused by ConAgra's negligence. But that in no way is a waiver of ConAgra's immunity against claim payments to its own employees. All this is a general indemnification clause, the quintessential one. The court below, we respectfully submit, erred by reading the different indemnification provision in Section 10.1 of the contract, which is a very specific indemnification provision, into Section 10.2. But all we have in Section 10.2 is a classic general indemnification provision, and the majority rule among the states, reinforced by the Supreme Court of Washington, Illinois, Ohio, Maine, Pennsylvania, have all said that given that workers' comp immunity for the employer is a cornerstone of the whole system, a general indemnification clause that doesn't specifically allude to workers' comp is insufficient to waive that cornerstone immunity, that you need some reference to claims against employees, for instance, as Jacobs has in Section 10.1. And as this court has found in a couple of cases, Otto and Union Pacific, that both reference claims by employees. So our point is we'd encourage this court to follow actually what it already said in the Harsh decision, which is that there can be a waiver of an employer's workers' comp immunity only where the employer has, quote, explicitly agreed to reimburse a third party for payment to an injured employee. So again, I can't stress strongly enough how the Section 10.2 is quite a different provision than Section 10.1. The other side just kind of waves a wand and says, well, it's all kind of the same thing. They're mirror images. These are far from mirror image provisions.
Has this very contract been interpreted by other courts?
Not to my knowledge, John. It was a negotiated contract between these parties.
Is it ambiguous?
We don't think it's ambiguous, but certainly I think even if it were ambiguous, I think the point is a tie goes to us as the employer with workers' comp immunity, that you don't lightly assume that an ambiguous contract would be enough to waive that workers' comp immunity because it's such a cornerstone of the whole system. So the trial court held that it was unambiguous the other way. We certainly think that, again, it's not ambiguous because the first clause is just a limitation on their liability, and the second clause is just, okay, for everything for which your liability is not limited, we will indemnify you. So general indemnification clause. So it really does present, I think, very starkly this issue about whether Nebraska should remain with the majority rule that a general indemnification clause does not waive workers' comp immunity, absent some reference to payments to employees.
This has sort of been asked, and you've sort of answered it, but did you draft that clause, or did did Jacobs?
This was a negotiated contract, Your Honor, so neither party has invoked the kind of contra preferentum policy or rule here. These are two sophisticated multi-billion-dollar businesses, and so we certainly negotiated for Jacobs to indemnify us in a wide variety of ways. I think the contrast between 10.1 and 10.2 really underscores that these are not mirror images. The indemnification obligations of Jacobs are quite specific and specifically include claims by Jacobs' own employees, ConAgra's employees. You contrast that to 10.2, it couldn't be more different. This is something that ConAgra really cared about. You know, not every image in a contract is a mirror image of each other. Sometimes parties put more care more about certain things.
If you cared about it so much, why would you not have put in a specific clause about workers' comp?
Well, because you don't need it under the law, Your Honor. Again, I think...
I think you're saying everybody knows.
Well, I think that's right. That in other words, the general rule is you don't presume that somebody is waiving that fundamental and critical right. In the absence of that, you don't need an exclusion. I think that's the lesson of the cases that we've cited from Supreme Courts of Ohio, Illinois, Washington State, again, I think, and frankly, of this Court's own decision in Harsh.
Does it matter to our analysis at all that the workers' compensation benefits here were paid under North Carolina law?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because this is a purely contractual question. Wherever the accident occurred, the task for this Court is to interpret what this clause means. What is the waiver here? And this is a choice of law provision, 18.7 of the contract says this is a Nebraska law issue. So you wouldn't want a situation where the answer to this waiver would depend on wherever the vagaries of whether this took place in Alaska or Florida or here. It's really a question of contractual intent, not actual payment under the workers' compensation.
Is that why this case is here versus North Carolina?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a choice of law and a choice...
Who made that choice to file the case here?
Well, the contract provides for that, and Jacobs sued here. Jacobs came here. Exactly.
Who wanted Nebraska in the negotiations?
I'm not sure the record speaks to that, Your Honor.
What's your guess?
What's that?
What's your guess?
You know, I don't like to guess on things on which I don't know a record-based answer.
Where's Jacobs' place of business?
It's certainly multinational. It's not in Nebraska. At that time, ConAgra was in Nebraska. But,
thank you.
You know, again, parties certainly choose different jurisdictions for a variety of reasons. One other point I'd really like to shift to now, I see my time is moving on, is the real party and interest issue. And this is a very strange case in the sense that this is an indemnification case, which is at bottom the case about reimbursement. Yet Jacobs has vehemently and vigorously, from the outset of this case, refused to provide any evidence that it actually paid a penny towards any, much less every one of these settlements. And Jacobs' position, we saw it discovered in this. We filed a motion to compel. We said, we need to know who's the real party interest here. So we filed this motion to compel, specifically saying we need this information about who paid what to discern who's the real party interest. This was a March 18th, 2015 brief.
Was that ever brought up before The trial was completed and the verdict was entered?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there a motion to dismiss?
It was not a motion to dismiss, but but everybody understood that this discovery motion was, in a sense, teeing up the real party interest issue.
And the point of that in plain speak is who wrote the check? Who suffered the loss?
The real party in interest issue says, and this goes back in many cases, Countryside, Jelinek.
Aren't those both subrogation cases? Aren't you conflating the principles of law that apply to real party in interest in equitable and contractual subrogation cases and laying those into contractual indemnification situations?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because there's a line that it becomes a subrogation matter, and you're correct to this extent, if and when it is decided that the insured paid at least something. Our problem here, and this is what Your Honor just said was the trial court's response when we filed this initial motion. The problem is that assumes that that they paid at least something. In the absence of paying anything, then you're in the Jelinek side of that line, not the Krauss side of that line. And so we don't know whether we are in the world of subrogation or whether we're in the world of deciding whether or not you're the real party in interest for each and every one of these settlements.
Do you have to write a check to suffer?
Well, you certainly
have to write a check. Would your experience rate be impacted and stuff like that?
Well, Your Honor, if you're seeking indemnification is reimbursement for payments. They're seeking reimbursement for the settlement. They're not seeking payment or reimbursement for other things. So you have to ask, did they actually pay even a penny towards any of the settlements at issue? And I'd like to point Your Honors to Bill of Exception, page 544, where we kept bringing this issue up, and Jacobs said on that page, Your Honor, I think we've been down this road before, and let me tell you where I think we've gone. As of April of 2015 in this case, the ruling of this court was that Jacobs is the real party in interest. If it's paid any portion of the settlement, it can recover the whole amount. So they're recognizing the legal rule that they have to have paid something. They just never proved on this record that they paid anything. And contrary to what they're saying in their brief, the trial court here never found that they paid anything. If you look at the post-trial motions, in both the motion denying our JNOB and our new trial motion, the trial court specifically said that the reason that they were a real party interest was that they had made a demand on Jacobs and had not released their claims. But that doesn't actually prove that they paid a nickel towards anything.
What's the ramification if they're not the real party in interest?
The proper remedy is to dismiss them. They have the burden of showing that they have standing if the court has jurisdiction. If a plaintiff comes into court and doesn't establish that it has standing, it can't go up through appeal, fight every step of the way, producing the evidence that would show that the court has jurisdiction, and then say, oh, guess what, heads I win, tails you lose, now let's just go back for a hearing and we'll show what we paid and when. I mean, there's a reason that this is a very odd situation that they have not showed. Even in their brief now, they don't say that they actually paid anything.
So based on the record, they're not the real party in interest, the case is dismissed, the judgment's void?
That's correct, because that is a prerequisite. As a plaintiff, you have to prove certain things. One of those things is that you have standing and that the court has jurisdiction.
I keep getting a little bit befuddled. It's probably me and not you. But parties to this contract are ConAgra and Jacobs.
That's correct.
Correct?
Yes.
So if it is a breach of contract provision, an alleged breach of the indemnification clause of that contract, if anybody other than Jacobs brought it and tried to enforce it, what would your position be?
Well, if they were the real party in interest, they would have to. This would happen in Jelinek. The real party in interest has
Jelinek
to be the one.
Jelinek was a subrogation case.
Well, no, in Jelinek, it was a real party in interest case because they said
in a subrogation context.
But because they said that the insured actually was not the right person to bring it. It had to be the insurer then.
So if Boyd brings this case in Omaha against ConAgra, what's your position going to be at that point?
One thing we would certainly want to do is see if there's an anti-subrogation problem. I mean, this may be one of the reasons why they're not telling who's behind the curtain. Because if their insurer, who actually is maybe the real party in interest, is our insurer, then they're blocked. I mean, there's something mysterious going on here. I don't know if it's the anti-subrogation rule, or maybe some of these payments were made by the malpractice insurer in the Brockington case. Again, we don't know that. That's the problem here.
But in indemnification clause, you don't need to wait until a payment is made. You could have, ConAgra could have been involved in the first litigation because of the indemnification provision. You would have had the right to be involved in that, wouldn't you?
That's correct. But the
why the focus on whether or when a payment is made if it is the indemnification agreement
Because we denied indemnification, and the indemnification they're seeking here are payments for the settlement. If they didn't make payments for the settlement, they're not making a claim that we breached indemnification through not paying a litigation expense. They're making a claim that we owe them for their settlement payments. I see my time is up. I hope I can
Is there some evidence of what their coverage was in force?
Put some policies in the record, right, that do have some copayment and deductible provisions. But proof of policies is not the same as proof of payment. And we certainly don't know that for every one of these settlements that they actually paid a nickel. It could be those policies show that there are coverage limits and copayment limits. You don't pay over a certain amount. So we don't know for any of these settlements, again, much less every one of these settlements, whether they're the real party interest and paid a nickel. It could be, for instance, that the Brockington settlement was entirely paid by the malpractice carrier for the law firm that got the default judgment.
Counsel, as I understand what you're saying here today, other than your motion for discovery, you never made a motion to the court bringing to the court's trial court's attention your concerns about the real party interest.
Well, because, Your Honor,
yes or no, did you do that?
We did not bring a separate motion before trial on the real party in interest.
Okay, then how, in Nebraska, there's a statute, I believe, that says that the case won't be dismissed unless you reasonably give the other party notice of the real party in interest to allow them to amend.
Sure.
How does that statute then work with your argument here today?
Sure.
If you didn't do that before trial?
Well, I think we did. The statute says an action shall not be dismissed on the ground that it is not prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest until a reasonable time has been allowed. Certainly, they say this, as I read from that quote earlier, they were on notice, and they were the ones that were saying that they interpreted that discovery motion as the court's ruling on the real party in interest. Again, Bill of Exceptions 544 makes it very clear that everybody understood that when the court rejected our motion to compel, that was, they themselves, this is in Jacob's mouth, that was the real party in interest.
So you're saying a motion for discovery is the same as a motion the court?
It was understood that way by the litigants here, and we raised this again. We filed a second motion to compel. They came back and they said, wait, you've already covered this ground, Your Honor. When we got to trial, we brought it up again. Let's assume, Your Honor, for a second. At least at trial, they could have said, you know something? Yeah, we recognize there's a problem. They don't even dispute that we filed a motion for directed verdict at the end of their case. If they had said, yeah, now we recognize that there's a problem, they could have come in. Even after trial, in the post-trial motions, we brought this up.
Isn't the burden always on the moving party on any issue, and that issue, you're the moving party, so why would they have to come in when you're the moving party?
Because it's an issue of standing and jurisdiction. They have a burden to show, and this is in Countryside, Your Honor, this is in this court's decision in Jelinek, this is in this court's decision in Rice versus Adam, which is 254 Neb, 219, 225. A plaintiff always has the burden of showing that it belongs in court, it has standing, it has jurisdiction. So it's not our burden to disprove their standing. They have to prove that they made some of these payments. Like, it's just kind of natural. If you come in saying, I'm entitled to indemnification because I made these payments, you have to provide some evidence that you actually made the payments. It's not something you can kind of keep behind the curtain. Again, for all we know, we have been ordered to pay them indemnification money for money that they never spent because, let's say, the Brockington payment settlement was paid all by the malpractice insurers. We just don't know. There's a complete evidentiary void here. And this is a situation where you can't have a heads-I-win-tails-you-lose situation where after you go all the way to the Supreme Court of Nebraska, you turn around and say, okay, well, now I'll have a hearing and now I'll show something. I mean, at the very least, there should be a hearing. But certainly, I don't see any way you could affirm this judgment without not one bit of evidence in the record that they paid a penny on this when that was their burden, again, on standing and jurisdiction. And they make a big point. They're trying to say this is not standing, this is not jurisdictional. That is absolutely incorrect as a matter of black-letter Nebraska law. This is standing and jurisdictional. We If there's no further questions, I don't know if I still have any rebuttal time, but I'll reserve whatever time I may or may not have.
I don't believe you do, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good morning. You are Mr.
Kinnaird.
Mr. Kinnaird, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Stephen Kinnaird for Jacobs. Conagra has identified no error that justifies overturning the verdict of the jury after a four-week trial or Judge Randall's sound legal rulings. I'd like to begin with the workers' compensation issue because I believe that the contract, considered as a whole, is clear. So Section 10.1, which defines Jacobs' liability, creates that liability for every claim or loss of Conagra by third parties, employees of Conagra, employees of Jacobs, or their personal representatives or dependents. And Section 10.1 then in turn cross-references 10.2 and says, contractor's liability is specifically limited as provided herein, and that Conagra has the duty to indemnify and release all other claims to the extent caused by the negligence of Conagra or those under its control. So what that phrase means...
Other than what?
It means other than the claims for which Jacobs is liable, because Jacobs was only liable to the extent of its negligence. And what the Conagra maintains, they say that because the exact verbiage of 10.1 is not repeated in 10.2, it's excluded. And that's an unnatural reading of the contract. And as Judge Randall found, it would also render the indemnification clause meaningless. Because if you exclude all third-party claims, all employee claims, all representative claims, there's nothing left. And so this court has said that a contract must be given a reasonable construction. You can't have a construction that yields absurd results where commercially sophisticated parties would agree to an indemnification clause of no scope. That doesn't make sense. They also misunderstand the proper legal rule in this jurisdiction. And I would add that the fact that there is an adoption by cross-reference of the express language of 10.1 into 10.2 satisfies any standard. But this court actually rejected the analysis of the five state Supreme Courts upon which they rely. As Mr. Landaus points out, those jurisdictions use the conception that what a contract is doing is waiving the workers' compensation immunity. And this court took a different view, siding with the scholar Larson, the Larson Treatise. And this is very important, so I'm going to read the language from Union Pacific at 169. And it says, as Larson explains, the immunity conferred is only against actions for damages on account of the employee's injury. A third party's action for indemnity is not exactly for damages, but for reimbursement, and it is not on account of the employee's injury, but on account of breach of an independent duty owed by the employer to the third party. So what this court is saying is that this is not a waiver of the statutory immunity. The statutory immunity against tort liability and contribution liability remains intact. It's an independent duty. This is an exception, the court says, to immunity. So what this court said is you apply traditional principles of contract interpretation. You look to ascertain the intent of the parties. And a specific language requirement would defeat the intent of the parties.
Mr. Landau, I believe, cites our, I think it was the Harsh case.
Right.
What is your response to that?
Harsh did not, it's Union Pacific and Auto that addressed the question of when the fact that you can still recover on an express contract. So that was not the issue in Harsh. Harsh was just the precursor about the scope of contribution. So I think it's very clear that the legal rule here is properly what Judge Randall said. And then on real party and interest, I'd like to begin with correcting an error of law on page 4 of Conagra's reply brief. In Railway Company versus Ramsey, not cited in the briefs, but it's 89 U.S. 322-327, the Supreme Court held that although acquired parties may not confer jurisdiction, a court may find jurisdiction based on the admission of the parties of jurisdictional facts. And that's what occurred here. Conagra in the answer operative at the time of Judge Randall's ruling on real party and interest, admitted that Jacobs had incurred settlement costs. And then in all of its subsequent answers, it likewise admitted that fact and denied only Conagra's obligation to indemnify those costs. So I think the admissions are enough. Second, the insurance policies in the record disclosed that Jacobs had a 10% copayment obligation on the primary insurance layer, $35 million above a $7.5 million
retention. How many layers were there?
There was also a tower on top of that, but that's the primary insurance
and
layer.
And the terms of that
are not in the record. What?
Okay, but the terms of it attribute some payment to Jacobs if it's adhered to.
The only question is whether Jacobs paid part of the $108 million in the whole. So the fact that they did have copayment on the primary insurance layer is enough. And I would point out, under a preponderance of the evidence standard, the trial court could find from the circumstantial evidence that more probably than not, Jacobs partially paid part of the $108 million. Third, even if this court were to find that more evidence is necessary, the remedy is not dismissal. Because the statute specifically provides, as Your Honor states, that an action shall not be dismissed on the ground that it is not prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest until a reasonable time has been allowed after objection to jurisdiction, after objection for joinder or substitution of the real party in interest. And the uniform federal authorities, which are persuasive on this point, hold that trial by ambush, by withholding your objection to jurisdiction, to standing until trial, is not sufficient. And Conagra never made
it. Mr. Landau says you always have that burden.
I think that we cited cases that are the contrary. Real party, and if you're contesting the real party in interest, you have to specifically plead it. I think the burden is on them. But regardless, I think they can't get dismissal.
So what's the remedy?
If you find that the record is insufficient, the remedy is to remand for a determination of who the real party in interest is.
Well, let's just say hypothetically it's not Jacobs. What happens then?
Then you have joinder or substitution. And it's important
after verdict
and judgment. And this court has held that. In New Light versus Wells Fargo, 252 Nebraska 958, that was pre the amendments. Even pre the amendments, it said that if it's not the proper party, you can substitute even after verdict or judgment, so long as it does not alter the cause of action. And subrogation never alters the cause of action. It's simply if it's full subrogation, and it wasn't here. But if it were, it would simply transfer the cause of action from Jacobs to the insurers. That's what the court held in Jelinek. So under that clear authority, and then the 1999 amendments even expanded on this principle. And as this court said in Fisher, the legislature has held that there is no limit to relation back in 25301, even if there is prejudice, which New Light had required showing.
I don't want to take us too far down that road, but Jacobs is not the real party interest. Another insurance company is there anti-subrogation issues that then come up after that determination is made? So now we say, okay, the real party is this Lloyd's or whoever it may be. Now we have a judgment for Lloyd's. So the next question is going to be, is there anti-subrogation issues? Keep going?
Anti-subrogation is a red herring here for two reasons. First, the district court rejected that defense. They didn't assign error to that. Second of all, you only have the anti-subrogation issue arise if Conagra were an insured under the policy under which they paid. There's no allegation or fact supporting that.
Is it possible that we should be talking about necessary party?
No, I think what happens is if there's no other necessary party, if Jacobs partially paid, which it did and which it can show, which I believe we've already showed, but...
What's your best evidence that Jacobs paid some?
As long as Jacobs paid, and they agree with this, any paid a penny, then that's enough. Then the action continues to reside with Jacobs, and it's the real party in interest.
And you're to answer the question that was posed. Your best evidence of that are the admissions?
Our best evidence are the admissions and then the insurance policies that are in the record. They objected.
The insurance policies don't They just say what party's obligations are. They don't tell us what actually happened in real life, do they?
No, they're not direct evidence of the payment. They are circumstantial evidence. You can deduce that it's a preponderance of the evidence.
Okay.
I mean, they raise the speculative theory that an insurer is going to waive a copayment obligation. That's pretty unlikely. And the judge can certainly find.
So you would say the best evidence is the admission to which you referred and the obligations under that first layer.
That's right.
Do we have the releases in the record?
The settlements are in the record, yes.
Have they been redacted, though?
They were redacted.
We don't know who paid it.
We don't know who paid, but the fact that there were settlement and that Jacobs had obligations under the policy, I think would allow the judge to find that by a preponderance of the evidence. Just more probable than not is the standard there. And Your Honor, I'd like to address the malpractice insurance. The payment to Jacobs, the malpractice...
Did Judge Randall ever make a finding like that? In other words, has a trier of fact actually made a factual finding, as you suggest, would be supported?
He did make a finding. I believe it was based on the admissions, because the admissions were made in the 2014 answer. He ruled in April 2015. He ruled out real party in interest, even though they didn't really raise it in the motions. They certainly didn't raise the motion to dismiss, because they were putting it in their hip pocket. So I think it is a finding. And by the way, on page 4 of their brief, they disclaim any attack on factual findings. They say we're only raising issues of law. I'd also like to point out, and I think Your Honor raised the point, subrogation is never a contract defense. So, and there are three reasons for that. One is that the judge found that the collateral source rule applied to a contractual liability based on wrongdoing. They did not assign error to that, even though they tried to argue that in their reply brief, we believe, improperly. Second, subrogation is only a transfer if it's full. It's not a contract defense. It was Jacobs, it's the injured party by the breach, and the damages, regardless of payment, inure to Jacobs. And third, it's important to point out that this contract
the damages
here...
damages, regardless of payment, are Jacobs?
Yes, because they were paid on behalf of Jacobs, and then there's a trust relationship. So Jacobs would be a trustee as to any payment that it would try to recover, or if there's full subrogation, then there's a transfer of the cause of action. But it's a transfer. It's not a defense to the cause of action. Therefore, it was not a jury issue. It was an issue for the court at most. And I would also like to point out that the contract here, and Conagra repeatedly ignores this, it's a very broad indemnification agreement because it requires, imposes a duty on Conagra to indemnify claims separate and apart from its duty to indemnify losses. So what that means, if Conagra's negligence is a cause of the claim, and the judge found instruction 2 as a matter of law that if you cause the explosion, you cause the claim, therefore you have causation, and you don't do a separate causation inquiry for every associated expense and loss with the claim. So I think that's yet another reason. Mr. Landau has also attacked the loss causation. He didn't argue it, but I'd point out two quick points on that. One, the contractual issue, but secondly, the settled rule that when Conagra had notice, a tender of the defense, and a declined indemnification, it doesn't get to challenge the Jacobs' decision to settle rather than to continue to litigate. And the reason is that the law favors settlements. You don't want to force indemnities to hold out and not pay injured parties.
Did Conagra, in fact, recommend settlement?
It did. It did at trial. It said, and that goes to also the issue of potential liability. So it said, you ought to settle this case. You have a substantial risk of a verdict. And in any event, the subjective motivations of Jacobs to settle or how it calculates its indemnification demand is ultimately irrelevant. The question is, do you have potential liability such that the settlement's in good faith and that the amount is objectively reasonable? There was no challenge to the instructions on that and no challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence. So this court ought to affirm across the board.
Choice of law?
The choice of law?
North Carolina or Nebraska?
The contract chooses Nebraska. By the way, we think the result is the same either under Nebraska or North Carolina. But there's an Ohio District Court case which we think is properly decided that if you're the question about whether or not you have an exception to a statutory immunity, you ought to look to the statute, even if the overall choice of law, maybe, you know, it's, the idea would be that Nebraska would choose North Carolina law in that circumstance.
With respect to the workers' comp exposure, or just generally
yes,
in the contract?
And North Carolina has a specific provision, which I think this court has found implied in the statute, but North Carolina specifically says this does not prevent an express action of contractual indemnity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't believe we have time for rebuttal. No time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day.